I will call this hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 7th, 2023. We do have a quorum present, so first item of business will be moving the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 2nd, 2023?
So moved.
Whoa. We'll go. Representative Carroll moves the minutes of February 2nd, 2023. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. All right. First thing on the agenda today is we're going to have a budget presentation by Civil Legal Services. So if you guys want to come up. And members, the PowerPoint that's on the screen, you also have printed out in your packets. Executive Director Rappaport, if you want to introduce yourself, and then go ahead with your presentation. And members, we'll have a presentation, and we'll have some time to ask questions if we have them. So please go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, hello, I'm Dori Rappaport. I'm the Executive Director at Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota. With me today are my colleagues from the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition, Ann Hefkin from Legal Services Northwest Minnesota, Jesse Nicholson from Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, Danielle Shelton-Bolchak, Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, Cody Nelson, Anishinaabe Legal Services, and Jean Lastine from Central Minnesota Legal Services. Civil Legal Services is comprised of 26 independent nonprofit organizations whose collaborative efforts create a statewide system for civil legal aid. These programs work together to provide free services to low-income individuals in poverty law cases. These are cases that impact the safety, security, and stability of everybody's lives. This means assisting individuals with legal representation in matters that surround family law, housing, safety, income, access to care, the ability to live independently, employment law, and more. We do this by providing representation, coordinating legal clinics, providing legal advice and information, creating resources that are easy for people to understand, and outreach to help people identify that they even have a legal issue. To receive our services, individuals must be income eligible. That's between 125 and 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. Individuals must meet our organization's stated priorities, and their cases must be meritorious. The majority of civil legal services clients are from communities that have disproportionately high poverty rates, such as Black, Indigenous, people of color, people with disabilities, the elderly, the LGBTQ plus community, and veterans. In 2021, Civil Legal Services helped 93,570 Minnesotans. We closed 43,762 cases. Considering everything that happened in 2021, all the incredible challenges that happened as a result of the pandemic, this was no small feat for a system of under 500 FTE. It was an incredible achievement that showed steadfast dedication and innovation to ensuring that we're able to meet our critical mission. But the reality is, despite the incredible work of civil legal services across the state, this system is not functionally serving Minnesotans who need it. There's two primary problems, compensation and capacity. So first with compensation. I remember in 2007, I was looking for jobs in legal services. Starting salary was $45,000. 10 years later, when I started as executive director at Legal Aid, the starting salary was still $45,000. That's over a decade that the starting salary didn't move. We have been neglecting compensating civil legal services staff for too long. And this is an opportunity for us to actually make up for what's been this narrative that we must do the most with the least. We can't do that anymore because we aren't able to provide a functional system when that's our narrative. So we have put resources towards salaries. You can see that the current starting salary for civil legal services is $56,362. But that's below what a judicial law clerk makes. Judicial law clerks have to take a pay cut to come and work for us where they have clients, where they have caseloads. Our partners in the public defender's office are starting currently at $70,146 for attorneys. We're still trailing them. We're still $15,000 at least behind them. And they project that they should be starting their attorneys at $82,908 in fiscal year 2024. We need to stay caught up. We can't be left behind. We are still the lowest paid public sector legal positions, and we have to stay competitive or we won't keep staff. It does make a difference. So in 2021 and 2020, our turnover rate was 32%, which was horrible. We invested resources in salary parity progress, and it worked because now we saw in 2022 that we're down to 24% for turnover. That's still too much. That's still way too much. But it has moved the needle, and that's what we need to keep doing. Otherwise, we'll lose what momentum we've gained. So the other problem after salary is capacity. Equal access to justice for all is not reality in Minnesota. The system currently supports the notion that access to justice is not a right, it's a privilege. If you can pay for a lawyer, then you have a chance at justice. If you cannot, you're forced to figure out a system, which many of you know, is designed for lawyers and not lay people. The majority of people who are in civil court are people in poverty, and the majority of those people are unrepresented. This means if you're not represented, you could lose your housing, you could lose your kids, you could lose your finances, you could lose everything. Of the people who learn that legal aid is actually a resource, civil legal services can only provide resources to 45% of those individuals. But that doesn't mean that those individuals are actually being fully served. We represent as many of them as we can, but some of them we have to give legal advice or limited services to. Recently, we determined that only 28.6% of those people are actually being fully served. This is unacceptable, and it is so hard for our staff to have to tell the people that we're working with, I'm sorry, I can't represent you in this case, but I can represent you. Those are decisions that nobody wants to have to make. We haven't even talked about all the people that don't know legal aid is an option for them, because the reality gets worse. In Minnesota, there are 1.2 million people who are in poverty. And according to the Legal Services Corporation 2022 Justice Gap Report, three-fourths of all people in the nation living in poverty have had at least one civil legal problem in the previous year. This means that Minnesota's civil legal system only had the capacity to serve 10% of Minnesota's poverty population to those who needed the services. That's 93,000 people out of 900,000 people. It's absolutely unacceptable. When we're asked, what would it take to fully fund legal aid, we're looking at what would it take to pay our staff competitive public sector wages, and what would it take to increase our capacity to help significantly more Minnesotans in poverty. This before you is a six-year plan that aims to get salaries where they need to be and incrementally increase our capacity over time. So there's two corrections to your handout if you're looking at it. Under fiscal year 24, the increase to the base should read 9.384, and the first listing of the capacity building in fiscal year 28 should read 13.2 million. The red font reflects civil legal services change item request and what's been included in the governor's budget. The rest of the numbers demonstrate what would be needed in the course of 6 years to achieve what we see as fully funded. The bill that will be before you today can make this plan a reality. Sometimes it's hard to visualize what fully funded could look like. So we've tried to show you that here in this slide. Fully funded means full service to priority cases. That means we don't have to pick and choose who we represent from beginning to end. That means representing everyone that's coming to us when their immediate needs are at risk and they need representation in the legal system. That means being present at domestic violence courts to help all survivors ensure that they are protected. And that means being present in coordinated housing calendars to ensure that people don't lose their homes. That'll also allow us to expand our priorities beyond those core critical services. That will allow us to do things that you before have asked us if we can increase our capacity to do. Can we help more people in family law cases? Can we help more veterans? Help with additional tenants' remedies? Help with employment and consumer law? We can finally expand priorities to make a bigger impact. And then on top of that, we can reach the people that don't know that legal aid is a resource for them. We can be part of community-based services, and we can continue to invest in our technological infrastructure to create innovative access points to ensure that all people have access to legal services and all people have access to the justice system. This is an opportunity to fix decades of underfunding. To invest in legal aid means to ensure the fairness and functionality of the justice system, benefiting our state's economy, our housing crisis, the future and safety of children and families. Investing in legal aid is investing in interventions for the justice system. You can invest now instead of more later. Please ensure that equal access to justice is a reality for all of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. Members, before we move on to the bill, are there questions or discussion to the handout and the presentation? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And to the testifier, did I miss it? Is there somewhere in this presentation that talks about your other sources of funding?
Executive Director Rappaport.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, thank you for the question. If you look at the fully funded civil legal services sheet, you can see that the dark blue reflects the total CLS budget, and the state base is the middle box, the lighter box. So we didn't include a slide today just because of time, talking about all of our different sources of funding, but civil legal services programs do receive federal funding from the Legal Services Corporation, multiple sources of funding from other state, local, county resources, foundations, private fundraising. So there is a spectrum of resources that support civil legal services.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Is that something that you could get to the committee members, just how much you've received from each of the entities that you do receive funding from?
Executive Director Rappaport.
Chair Becker-Finn. Yes, of course we could.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you kind of give us a historical perspective on that, too? The last 4 years or something like that, how each of those entities has funded you. That'd be very helpful.
Yeah, and Director Rappaport, if you know even, you know, generally, you know, is it percentage-wise, or I think it would kind of give folks an idea of why the state funding is important.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Scott, thank you. The state funding to support civil legal services has comprised of a significant portion of the total budget for civil legal services. It is critical. It is at least 35%, and this is me saying this off the top of my head, of the total revenue for civil legal services. We are happy to provide data for the how the different sources of revenue historically come into our system. But the movement towards improving the way we do things starts with funding from the state. And then we are able to go to our other sources of revenue and say, here's where we also are going to need increases to see a meaningful impact in how we deliver services. Thank you.
For the follow-up, Representative Scott.
Okay. Anyone else? Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank you for the great work you do. As a lawyer, I know that if people don't have representation, that often will go pro se and represent themselves, and that is really difficult on not only the person that's trying to represent themselves, but all the other folks in the system and the judges and the efficiency of the process. So I just wanted to point that out because I really think that the work you do is so vital, not only because you're helping people with their needs, but also for the efficiency of the judicial system. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Find, Ms. Rappaport, I'm just wondering, since all these civil legal services corporations that you represent and you're working here today for are all 501c3 nonprofit corporations privately run, I'm just wondering, because we're looking at in the goal for is for 2029, which is only three budget cycles away, is almost $112 million of state taxpayer dollars given to grants to your corporations. Do you have, when you get that information that Representative Scott requests, could you also provide us with the amount of administrative costs that these grant dollars are paying for? Because we want to make sure that if we're doing anything like any grant money going to nonprofits, that the money is actually going for the purpose it was done for, not for administrative costs and stuff like that. I do have a concern that the state is running and paying for nonprofit corporations, because none of your employees are state employees. They're all private employees, not public sector employees. So, like I said, it's state tax dollars, the taxpayers' money, and we want to make sure it's being used properly. I myself have been in the civil courts system for damage to my wife's vehicle, but we didn't have civil legal services, and we didn't have any problems understanding how the system worked. There are some other complicated things that were your organizations do a fantastic job, but we just want to make sure the money is being used properly.
Director Rappaport.
Chair Becker-Find, Representative Johnson, thank you for the commentary and the question. And we certainly, I will confirm, we are 501c3 nonprofit organizations. And the dollars that go to the civil legal services programs go through a competitive grant process that's administered by a committee of the state Supreme Court to ensure that the dollars are being used in the best way possible. We take very seriously our mission and our job to ensure that we are putting adequate money towards direct services. We historically have been incredibly lean in any administration of the way that we operate. Our money is focused on providing increased direct services to individuals. And while I certainly understand that in some circumstances it may seem that you can go to court and fill out forms and get through the justice system, there is an air of crisis and an air of privilege and an air of understanding a system that is truly designed for lawyers, that people who have grown up in poverty and people who are in crisis cannot navigate and understand. And our presence is critical in order to help them protect their families, their safety, their security, their housing, their income, and their stability. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Johnson, I mean, if you want there to be more state government and more state employees, I'm sure that the legal aid attorneys would love to be unionized state employees, and maybe those numbers would be a little bit better for them. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerman, the reason I brought that up is we just received the OLA report on grants that the states provide, especially to nonprofits. And for those who haven't read it, I was just reading, it's the lack of oversight and accountability by a lot of the grants that are giving out is horrific. And so we want to make sure that the grants are being used properly.
All right, got our bingo card for the day on the OLA report. And I will note, the OLA report doesn't mention anything untoward as to what's to our civil legal services funding and the way that we do that with in concert with the Supreme Court. We'll go to one more member comment, and then we got to get moving on, and there will be time to ask questions to the underlying bill as well. Representative Carroll.
Well, I'll pass on that. I'll come back later on, but I just wanted to thank you for your service. I feel your pain. Having served in the Civil Division of Hennepin County Attorney's Office, I have a glimmer of a sense of what it must be like. You know, we always played second fiddle to people like Representative Moeller, who was in the criminal divisions, and who does great work, by the way. But so I have a somewhat of a sense, but these figures that you have are shocking to the conscious. It's just outrageous, I think. Thank you, Chair.
Yep, thank you. And like I said, we've got some testifiers on the underlying bill that actually moves this funding forward. So we'll keep those who are on the list. I'm sure it's still relevant to the overall discussion. So with that, I'm going to pass the gavel.
While the chair is making her way there, I will move House File 286 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Chair Beckerman, before you present, I see that you have a DE2 amendment to 286.
Yep, I'd like to move the DE2.
All right, please go ahead. We'll move the DE2, and you can explain the amendment.
So when we initially introduced this bill, as you see, it's House File 286. We want to get this introduced right away. The DE2 reflects the updated numbers that we got from Civil Legal Services that reflect what it would actually take and what was in that slide with that six-year plan.
Thank you. Any discussion to the DE2 amendment? Seeing no discussions, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The DE2 amendment is approved. Please move on.
Thank you, Chair. And I'll be real quick. This is the funding to meet what was in that slide that showed that six-year plan of how we could actually fully fund civil legal services. Similar to conversations around public defenders, I had asked the question, what would it actually take to fully fund your agent, you know, to fully fund things so that we aren't turning away over half the people who come, who qualify and ask for help. So that's what it does. And I want to make sure we have time for our testifiers because we do have people who traveled here. So I'd like to move on to our testifiers if that's okay, Chair Frazier.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Ms. Dory Rappaport, please come down. Welcome back. Please reintroduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Dory Rappaport, Executive Director, Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota. Today, we have three individuals that have come to testify, and we're excited to have you, to give you the opportunity to speak with them. So I actually will just quick say their names, and then if they can come up and individually say their bit. First, Kevin Swanberg. Kevin is a LASNM, Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota, certified student attorney. After Kevin, Mary Kaczorek. She's a Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid Supervising Attorney in the Housing Unit, followed by Suzanne Gurdon. She is a Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services Lead Attorney for Medical Legal Partnerships. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rapport. Mr. Swanberg, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Swanberg. As Ms. Rappaport said, I am a law student at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, and I am a student attorney at Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota. At Legal Aid, I represent clients in evictions and housing matters. I attend housing court and provide advice, counsel, and representation to people who are drowning, losing their homes. Their safety is threatened. And we try to throw them a lifeline. In that role, legal aid attorneys and myself will step in and try to negotiate to give these people a chance to keep their homes, to perhaps give them a little more time to move out so they don't end up homeless with an eviction on their record. And if they're being treated unfairly, we represent them at trial and help them to save their homes. The hardest part of that work for me is something that I have to do almost every day in that job, which is tell people that I can't represent them and I can't help them because we do not have the capacity to do so. We have to choose the most critical cases, the cases that have the most merit, and tell people who also have very fair legal claims that they will have to go alone and maybe send them some forms and some words of encouragement so that they can navigate the very complicated legal system by themselves. Something that I have seen as a student and working at LASNM is that an eviction, which is considered to be a small legal matter, can turn into a cascade of legal problems that chases people for years. Being evicted and losing your home may mean that you end up losing your job. It may mean that you end up losing your children. It may mean that you end up paying off a debt for years and cannot get a new home because you have an eviction on your record. So the work that we do in this space is absolutely critical to the people of the state. I'll finally say that as a law student, I talk a lot with other law students who tell me that they want to do this work. They want to serve their community. They want to serve their state. But the reality is that many law students leave law school with crushing student loan debt, and they can't afford to take a job at Legal Aid because they will not be able to pay off their loans. The money just isn't there. They can't do it. And so they have to choose to work elsewhere. But if we want good and passionate attorneys helping people on this very important work, then we need to show law students that they can afford to give people that help. So that's the last thing I'd like to say, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Swanberg, and hopefully you'll stay around if there's any questions. I too was a certified student attorney, and I had to forego an offer to work with Southern Regional Legal Services because I just couldn't make those finances work. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Up next, we have Mary Kozarek. I hope I didn't mispronounce that after I was just told how it was pronounced. Come on down. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Mary Kozarek, really close. that's fine. I am the managing attorney of the housing unit at Legal Aid's Minneapolis office. As the last testifier mentioned and everyone knows, we are in the midst of an eviction crisis. In Hennepin County last month, landlords filed over 750 eviction cases. This is more than we saw in June when the moratorium ended. It's vastly more than we saw pre-pandemic in a month. Legal Aid represents renters in eviction cases. We fight housing discrimination, and we help renters who need repairs in their homes. I remember a man I helped who came to Legal Aid after he and his family had been without heat for 4 days. His home was so cold that the pipes burst, the basement flooded, and a cup of water on his coffee table would freeze solid. He called his landlord over and over for help. No one picked up. No one called him back. He went to the property manager's office. Nobody was there. He called the police. The police couldn't help him. He didn't have money to go to a hotel. He had bought his own space heaters, hired his own plumber, had to buy restaurant food because his kitchen didn't work. He had nowhere to go. Finally, his cousin told him to call the attorney general's office, and the attorney general's office told him to call Legal Aid. The night before I spoke to this man, he told me that he and his wife, his home was so cold that he and his wife were worried their newborn baby was going to die. Excuse me. It was only after legal aid got involved that we used the emergency tenant remedies law that the landlord finally made these repairs, and we helped this tenant move into a new home where he and his family were safe. Last month, Legal Aid's Minneapolis office received over 6,000 calls from people needing help with all kinds of civil legal problems. Some of these cases are literally life or death cases. I urge the members of this committee to support this bill and to fully fund civil legal aid. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Ms. Suzanne Gurdon. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Gurdon. I am a civil legal services attorney with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. I have been at Smurls for 10 years. I am currently the lead attorney for our healthcare legal partnership. Prior to that, I mostly did family law. I'm here to testify this morning on behalf of our clients and how increased funding might affect our clients and the work we do. The primary client base that I represent are victims of domestic violence. A lot of people have been to court, and a lot of very educated people can kind of find their way around. But when we have a client who is in crisis, a client who is going to court to confront his or her, usually her, abuser, they're overwhelmed. I have been to court with so many victims of domestic violence that had no idea what was going on when we get out of the courtroom. So I'm there to help them get their relief, but I'm also there to help them prepare for trial, because the order for protection is a trial where a victim of domestic violence is confronting her abuser and also being cross-examined by him. To go into that by herself is traumatizing. We are there to guide these victims through the hardest thing they've ever done, and that is stand up to somebody who's in many cases tried to kill them, and often their children. We have a large victim base of children who have been abused, who come in through our healthcare legal partnership, and but for the fact that we are located in those in a couple of clinics, they would not even know we existed, as Director Rapoport testified earlier. They know of us because we're there. We also, with the limited number of attorneys that we have in our office, the level of outreach that we've been able to do has really decreased, especially in the metro. Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services covers 33 counties. Many, the great majority of them are rural counties, where the number of attorneys per person drops precipitously. And again, we are left to either give people advice in a pamphlet or to just not be able to represent them at all. When it comes to the impact on migrant families, on minority families, on people of color, and on rural populations, it's a very inequitable system, being unable to fund the number of attorneys that we would need to reach these people. So I'll echo what one of my colleagues said, is that having to turn somebody away is the most painful thing we can have to do. A lot of these cases are very complicated and time consuming, especially when we get into the family law realm. So that involves stamina, and it involves an attorney who can afford to stay through the end of that trial that sometimes might last over a year. Something else we've been seeing with the rise in the drugs of methamphetamine and fentanyl is that we have a number of missing parents who are not caring for kids. We have relative caregivers, oftentimes grandparents, who are caring for children without any legal custody label, and so when they get into clinics and hospitals, they can't get treatment. I've had a client call me from a clinic because her 7-year-old granddaughter needed major oral surgery for lack of dental care from her mother. This was the grandmother. They called me from the West St. Paul Children's Hospital Clinic across the river, begging me to talk to a doctor or an administrator there to get this child care. Now, kids can get emergency care by law, but when it comes to that follow-up care, they can't. So a huge increase in the cases that we're getting, and ones that are actually very rewarding, are these third-party custody cases of grandparents caring for kids whose parents are abandoning the children many times because of addiction. And so this is really impacting children and our southern county population and throughout the state, I can guarantee you. Last of all, we have in the metro, just north of the capital here, we have a very large Burmese immigrant refugee population. They make up the Karen community. Our healthcare legal partnership at Bethesda Clinic up on Rice Street helps a large number of these refugees who have come from war in Burma, who have staggering mental health and physical disabilities, who come to the United States, are given green cards, and are able to access Social Security SSI. They get that for 7 years and then they have to become a citizen. They have no idea how to go about that. So we're able to preserve a federal public benefit for them by representing them and getting them their citizenship, which is naturalization, which is not the same as representing asylum seekers. These are refugees who have come in from Burma, we are able to have them naturalized to become citizens so that they can earn benefits that other similarly situated individuals in their neighborhoods can get. So that's another huge need. The need there is enormous, and a lot of them have so many healthcare needs. They have children who also need to get their citizenship. So that's something that we're able to do. And there's a huge number, and doing a naturalization case is not particularly difficult, but it makes a massive impact. So if we just had more attorneys, young new attorneys, that's a really nice thing that they can do that makes a huge impact. And it's, we just need it's the numbers. So we're having to turn some of them away. We refer a lot of them to Immigrant Law Center, but we can't, there's only so much that they can take as well. I thank you for inviting us here today to testify, and I'll rest my case. Thank you.
Never take the lawyer out of a lawyer. Huh? Thank you, Ms. Gurdon. Just if I can quickly say, you brought up some great points there. Thank you for highlighting the need in Greater Minnesota. I think oftentimes we talk about building up infrastructure, and we think about our roads and our streets and our bridges, but there are some human infrastructure and systems that we need to make sure we invest in to really help Minnesotans. So thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
I see that we have someone who signed up from the public to testify, Dr. Roger J. Day. Come on down. Doctor, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. This is a fabulous opportunity, and it may not look like I'm really happy to be here, but I am. I'm a Minnesotan with a disability. And my disability stems from government abuses. So it's really hard for me to interact with government. It's really hard to come to this room today and ask for your understanding. The governor has a vision for one Minnesota. And so far it has not included me. I am not respected in Minnesota. I am not treated fairly in Minnesota. Have not been for 31 years. I've had a disability for 31 years caused by a procedural assault upon me where I did not get justice. I had a complaint made about me to the university, which was not true. It was supported by a counterfeit document, and that counterfeit document was just weaponized and used to destroy me. And I was told, "Well, this investigation isn't really a legal proceeding. You'll get legal rights on appeal," was what I was told on January 17th, 1992. So on Friday afternoon, January 17th, 1992, the University of Minnesota did a quasi-judicial assault upon me and directly ruined my life, but also created a problem for Minnesota and the wider world. The world does not know what happened on that date and what's wrong with all of the records since. I've been doing my best to manage the disability that this has caused, and I've now learned to seek out disability accommodations, and it's kind of in a new realm. My handicap is a procedural handicap. That I get so emotionally affected by legal procedures that I cannot function within them. And so I'm not financially impoverished. And so I don't qualify for legal aid for the financially impoverished. But what I am, I'm socially impoverished and I'm procedurally impoverished. And the Disability Law Center within legal aid can still help me based on my disability rather than on my finances. So I want to highlight that we need more money for the Disability Law Center so that the Disability Law Center can pursue justice where justice is not occurring for lack of disability accommodation.
Dr. Day, I want to thank you for sharing this story. I'm going to see if there's any more public testifiers, and then we want to get to the discussion because we do want to make sure we can get this bill moving so we can get that funding out. But I appreciate you coming to share that story. Would you like to take a couple of sentences to wrap up?
My representative offered me this line. Given the limited amount of time for public testimony, if any members of this committee are interested in learning more about the particular situation that I describe and how civil legal aid resources are critical to helping Minnesota in this situation, I am very happy to arrange time to meet with you individually to discuss this matter in more detail.
That's a perfect line, and I'd be happy to speak with you more about this.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any more public testifiers that would like to come up before we move on to member discussion? Seeing none, member discussion. Any members? Representative Bennett. Scott. Representative Scott. Sorry.
It's okay, Mr. Chair. Wrong Peggy.
Yeah.
I wonder if I could ask a question of Ms. Rappaport. Is she still in the room? There she is.
Represent Frederick, so tall you couldn't see her.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Ms. Rappaport, I've just noticed a really huge difference in between the governor's budget and what this bill asks for. And I wonder if you could speak to that. Did you have conversations with the governor's office? And if you know anything about the difference in what's being asked between the bill and the governor's budget, if you could address that.
Ms. Rappaport.
Chair, thank you. Representative Scott, for your question. The amount that we highlighted on the chart, the red fonted numbers, yes, those are the numbers that were part of Civil Legal Services budget request for this biennium and what's been included in the governor's budget. We wanted an opportunity to show this committee, because we've been asked multiple times, what will it take to fully fund civil legal aid? It will take a lot more. And so the numbers that are in blue show you how we could start building capacity now. Our priority has been salary parity. And so the number you see for fiscal year 24 is focused on continuing that salary parity progress. And then the numbers you see for fiscal year 25 actually starts the capacity building. If this bill were to pass, we could start with capacity building now. So we would add that
that $3.3 million to start with capacity building. So really the numbers you're seeing here, the color differential shows you, here's what at a minimum we need to do this session, and we're really grateful for the bill, which is before you, to help us on a trajectory of fully funding our system. And so the other colors show you, if we were to do that, here's how we need to start now. I hope that helps answer your question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that does help. And I was astounded at the difference. I've never seen a request, I don't think in my time in the legislature, for a quadruple of what of the current budget. And I do think there needs to be some salary parity for you guys. But this was kind of an astounding number that jumped off the page. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Breckenridge.
Thank you. And you know, and as and I think this really relates to the conversation we've had around public defenders, is nobody had previously been asking them what would it actually take to do this right. And I think, unfortunately, over the years, folks get coached to just ask for something that you might actually get and don't even dare to talk about what it looks like. And I think the important thing with this presentation today, and I really want to thank our testifiers today, is it really highlights what you can do when you actually fund this properly, because long term it actually saves us resources. It saves court resources, public safety resources, public benefit resources. You know, if those folks aren't seeking out emergency shelter and having to use all those other programs to get support, by having an attorney that helps them stay in their home, like that's a better outcome for everybody. So I recognize it's a big number, but I think it's better that we live in reality and talk about what's actually needed. And you know, no disrespect to chairs before me or the governor's office or anyone else who helps come up with these numbers, but I would rather live in reality and talk about what is actually needed. And so that's why the number is bigger.
Representative Scott. Thank you, Chair Breckenridge. Representative Niska. Representative Waynes.
Mr. Chair, my question is for Director Rappaport. Director Rappaport, I see you have veteran services on here, very near and dear to my heart. I'm curious, is that a separate division, or can you describe the number of veteran interactions or caseloads that you have, and if there's any special training for your attorneys and assistants that assist veterans?
Ms. Rappaport.
Chair, Representative, thank you so much for the question. We primarily are assisting veterans with housing issues. We have partnerships with other veterans organizations, including the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, that we are able to help veterans before they are facing homelessness. There's a lot of intervention to ensure that the conglomeration of mental health, income, employment, all of these issues are being addressed to help veterans stay in their homes. Now, veterans are receiving services for other types of issues beyond housing. I mean, we've helped them in family law matters, employment law matters, consumer debt matters. We are focused on trying to help veterans have stability and security in their lives. There are some jurisdictions that have veterans courts where they focus more on serving veterans in a holistic fashion. And so we have been involved in specialty courts and civil legal services. We hope to be able to expand what we're able to do for veterans if this bill is passed. So thank you so much for your question.
And Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Representative Waynes.
And also Representative Breckenridge, please interject. I'm always curious about success metrics, and we've heard much about how much we want to increase the budget and the salaries, but those metrics or a report back to this body by which we can see that we are advancing those particular things. So my line of questioning on veterans is I'd like to know how many we're actually seeing and assisting. And thank you for letting me know that MACV and the other nonprofits, as well as possibly the MDVA, is involved in that. I'm not certain that it is in here, but I would like to see a report back annually to our body on those objectives that we desire to have, that we are advancing, providing legal service to those that are challenged. So that's kind of my statement, my question, probably for Representative Beckerfin.
Chair Beckerfin.
Yeah, and I'm sure we can get that information. I mean, I know they keep really good statistics. I just asked them to keep the presentation pretty focused today so that we would be able to have time for the discussion. So I'm sure we can get that information and share it with the committee.
Representative Scott, you have one more question. I'll get
to
other members.
Briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the brevity allowing me to ask. To Ms. Rappaport, it's sort of maybe a process question, but it might go to the budget as well. When you have two parents that are both at poverty level that would qualify for your services for family law, how do you decide which parent you help?
Ms. Rappaport.
Chair, Representative Scott, thank you for your question. As law firms do, the party that contacts a legal aid program first, if there's no conflict of interest, will determine are they income eligible and do we have the capacity to help them. So say in that circumstance, party A calls first, there's no conflict, we've never assisted party B, we may be providing some level of service for them. If party B then contacts us like a law firm, it would potentially be a conflict of interest. But that is why we have a critical partnership with the private bar so that they're able to take cases pro bono and help where we cannot if there's a conflict on a family law type case.
Chair Beckerfin.
And I can actually, I clerked in family court and there's actually a rotating list where there are many, many family law attorneys that volunteer to be on that list. So when we do have a conflict case that the clerk can even help facilitate calling one of those attorneys to fill in so that you don't have a disparity in one of the parties not having an attorney. So it's pretty common, with law firms, I think, especially in smaller communities too.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to comment about Chair Beckerfin's leadership, and I appreciate your leadership. You just pointed out that you law clerked in family court. I was an attorney there, and you provided outstanding leadership at that time, and you are today. And I appreciate on this subject as well as the public defenders. And let me compliment Chair Frazier as well. So thank you for your service.
I was feeling left out.
Like a civil guy.
I've Mr. Chair, I've my whole life as an attorney has been in public interest law, whether it was clerking or at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office or here now. So.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. With no further discussion, Chair Beckerfin, would you like to close and then we'll get to a vote?
Yep. Just want to highlight how legal aid, and that actually is a great segue into, I also want to highlight, you know, how legal aid does the best that they can by highly utilizing student attorneys. I also was a student attorney. I worked in the disability rights, Social Security benefits area as an intern, as a law student as well. So again, ultimately this is not only, you know, we heard the personal stories of how this impacts real life, real people, but it also ultimately saves our justice system money and resources by actually investing in this now. So it really is an investment in the future and in the people of our state, and would appreciate member support.
Thank you, Chair. I will renew my motion to refer House File 286 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. You're on your way, Chair Beckerfin.
All right, if the folks from the Guardian Ad Litem's office can come up. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tammy Baker Olson, and I am the program administrator for the State Guardian Ad Litem program. I'm here today to provide an overview of the program and talk about some details with our budget request for fiscal year 24-25. So it's important we start with our purpose and our mandates and what we do.
And members, you do have this in your packet as well.
Thank you. The Guardian Ad Litem program provides advocacy for children when appointed by a judge in a juvenile or family court proceeding and ensure children receive appropriate services and that their physical, mental, educational, and cultural needs are met. The role of the Guardian Ad Litem was established in 1974, and Guardians Ad Litem are mandated by both federal and state law. Administration of the Guardian Ad Litem program in Minnesota is the responsibility of the independent state Guardian Ad Litem board established in the judicial branch. Guardians Ad Litem are an independent voice representing the children's best interest. Guardians Ad Litem have specific federal and state mandated duties. The Guardian Ad Litem does not function as the child's attorney and does not provide direct resources to the child or services to the child. What the Guardian Ad Litem does do is represent the children's interests in court to ensure children have their primary needs met and that the court has information to rule confidently. This means Guardians Ad Litem conduct interviews and observe the children and significant people in their lives. They review social service, medical, school, psychological, and criminal records and reports. They attend meetings with other professionals involved with the children and their families. They make written and oral recommendations in court regarding the short and long-term best interests of the children. They monitor court-ordered plans to ensure the children's best interests are being met. All of this incredible effort starts with extensive training. Guardians Ad Litem are professionals with diverse backgrounds who have wide-ranging training and education in advocating for children. Guardians Ad Litem are required to have knowledge and advanced training in disciplines such as child development, chemical dependency, mental health, racial equality, court procedures, state statute, community resources, and the list goes on. Guardians Ad Litem are in every county in Minnesota, and the program is busy. Over the last year, Guardians Ad Litem advocated for the best interests of over 13,155 children in both juvenile and family court, and in over 30,000 court proceedings. The organizational chart you're looking at includes FTE by district and division to include employee and volunteer Guardians Ad Litem. The Guardian Ad Litem program has created many efficiencies and financial savings in recent years, in part by combining the management of six of the 10 judicial districts. The Guardian Ad Litem program was reviewed by the Office of Legislative Auditor in 2018, and in 2019, the program implemented a plan addressing the 19 OLA recommendations to ensure the program is as efficient and as effective as possible. Included in the OLA report was the recommendation the program track progress towards goals for a diverse, culturally competent workforce. I want to talk a little now about the program's race equity strategic plan. The Guardian Ad Litem Board is committed to building and sustaining a respectful and racially equitable program that promotes and advocates for the best interests of all Minnesota's children and families. By advancing our practice with a statewide lens on racial equity, our goal is to help eliminate disproportionality in the child welfare system. One step towards achieving this goal was the development of an independent statewide Indian Child Welfare Act division in the Guardian Ad Litem program. The ICWA division of the Guardian Ad Litem program began in October 2020 and was developed in response to the alarming removal rates of American Indian children in the Minnesota child welfare system. ICWA Guardians Ad Litem ensures statewide ICWA MIFWA compliance through a culturally informed lens and strengths-based practice towards family reunification, family preservation, and family healing. Having said all this, we are not without our challenges, and they are substantial. Guardians Ad Litem require specialized trainings and is our priority to hire and retain skilled, diverse, knowledgeable employees. However, current wages are not competitive enough to attract and retain staff. In 2022, the Guardian Ad Litem program commissioned an employee class and compensation study, which revealed an inequity in pay for guardians ad litem when compared to their child welfare counterparts. The issue of pay equity is impacting recruitment and retention of qualified and diverse hiring pools. The study further recommended a strategy to address wage compression and help ensure internal equity among employees in the same job classification. In addition, vacancies and departures have increased. The Guardian Ad Litem program has experienced a high number of vacancies, as many as 24 vacancies in any given month, which is a direct result of a lack of competitive wages. Guardians ad litem are leaving the program at 6.36 positions a month, which is a 17% turnover rate. And that brings us to today's budget request for fiscal year 24-25. The Guardian Ad Litem Board seeks an increase of $4,348,000 in fiscal year 24-25 biennium. This is an increase of about 9.5% of our overall budget. As stated, our key challenge, and it is at a crisis level, is recruitment and retention of qualified staff. This proposed budget would specifically increase the compensation pool by 9% in fiscal year 24 and 6% in fiscal year 25, as well as fund insurance premium increases. So we know there are similar workforce challenges across state government as well as the private sector. We also know the work that we do in the Guardian Ad Litem program is vital in helping children in the child protection system receive the necessary advocacy to address their physical, mental, emotional, and cultural needs. I want to thank you all for your time today and open up an opportunity for questions.
Thank you. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Baker. Also, I wanted to share a personal story with the committee and with you about the value of a guardian ad litem in a child's life. As some may know, I know Representative Scott knows, we have a daughter who was adopted from the child protection process, and she was a foster daughter of ours. She's biologically my niece. She went from being a 10-year-old malnourished child, someone told by other family members that she was dumb, to someone who is an all-conference soccer goaltender, twice the MVP of her soccer team, a talented artist, a voracious reader. She's a junior in high school. Every day she's coming home to letters from colleges. There are a lot of people that made a big difference in her life, obviously. Her attorney from the Child Legal Services, or Children's Law Center, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, but absolute rocks in her process were the first and initial guardian ad litem in Ramsey County, who was a bulldog in the very first child protection process, but then she was replaced by a full-time guardian ad litem in the Ramsey County Attorney's in Ramsey County, appropriately named Best. I hope that all of your guardian ad litems meet the standard that Deborah Best sets. I kind of doubt that's possible, to be honest with you. She was unbelievable. She got to know our daughter. She was trusted by the courts. She was trusted by everyone. And I asked her on the way to school this morning, what she remembered or what she wanted to share. And she just wanted to share that in a very difficult time, she knew that the guardian ad litem really cared for her. And my perspective was that she was absolutely essential to that process and what our daughter has gone through. So. None of that speaks to, exactly the right number that we have to decide in terms of your budget, but I just wanted to share with everyone, and thank you for the opportunity, Chair Becker Finn, to share my personal experience and our family's experience with the importance of a guardian ad litem, a good guardian ad litem in a difficult situation for a particular child. So thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. I think it really is critical. The guardian ad litem does not represent the parties, does not represent the state. The guardian ad litem is often the only person who is truly there just for the best interests of that kid. So thank you for sharing that, Ms. Baker Olson.
Any response? Sorry, Representative.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Ms. Baker Olson, I want to thank you for the work that the Guardian items do. I've worked with many of them in my career in law enforcement. They've been fabulous at looking after the best interest of the child, which is what their duty is. But I also want to call out, unfortunately, you're down to 58 volunteers. I want to thank those volunteers because they do a lot of work. And they don't do it for the money. They do it for the children. They understand the needs of the children. They have a passion to help those kids. So I just wanted to make sure that we thank the volunteers that are in this program as well.
Thank you. And members, with that, we will have, when we actually are moving the bill with the funding for the agency, they'll be back and we can ask more questions and get into the numbers a little bit more. But we're going to move on for today, but wanted folks to start thinking about that and have this in front of them. So thank you, Ms. Baker Olson, for being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you. All right, Representative Egbadje. I will move House File 366 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. I understand we have I believe it's mostly a technical amendment, the A3 amendment. So I will also move the A3 amendment. Representative Egbadje, if you can just confirm what that amendment does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment essentially refers back to the definition of reproductive care that's currently in the bill. And then the second part of the amendment, let me just pull it up, just clarifies that the acts that we're discussing in this bill are basically committing an act in the state means acts committed in the state of Minnesota, including any action taken while the person is physically present in Minnesota. So we just wanted to make those technical changes to the bill.
All right. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Egbadje, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm here today to discuss House File 366, which is also known as the Reproductive Freedom Defense Act. What it does is it protects Minnesota healthcare providers, Minnesota citizens, and patients from around the country against legal attacks and criminal penalties imposed by anti-abortion extremists in other states. This bill is necessary to protect the rights and access to reproductive health care for all Minnesotans, the health care providers who offer reproductive health services, and those from other states seeking care. The overturning of Roe versus Wade has led to a flood of harmful laws attacking not only abortion rights, but also individual liberties and privacy more broadly. States like Texas, Georgia, Arkansas, Mississippi, Missouri, and Alabama have passed or introduced laws that criminalize abortion with penalties that can include fines, imprisonment, and/or revocation of medical licenses for the abortion provider. It is deeply troubling to see laws passed whose sole purpose is to punish people who perform reproductive health care. I'm glad to carry this bill where we can say that we are creating strong protections for Minnesota's own health care providers and citizens against legal attacks and criminal penalties imposed by anti-abortion extremists in other states. This legislation would prevent Minnesota's courts and institutions from being hijacked and abused in service of a harmful agenda from those outside of Minnesota. House File 366 ensures that the law governing the release of health records excludes out-of-state subpoenas and court orders for records when in relation to laws from other states that restrict or punish the provision, receipt, or attempted provision or receipt of reproductive health care services to a patient. This ensures that disclosure laws cannot be weaponized for other states' prosecution of health care that is protected under Minnesota law. This bill also protects physicians, physicians' assistants, and nurses from disciplinary action and or not receiving a license solely because they may be coming from another state that has restrictive anti-abortion laws targeting healthcare providers. Further, the bill protects Minnesotans from laws encouraging citizens to sue individuals for providing or helping someone obtain abortion care and allows anyone sued in another state under one of these laws to countersue in Minnesota to recover any costs affiliated with that case. It also ensures that Minnesota courts will not enforce out-of-state judgments for these types of lawsuits. For the sections pertinent to this committee, the bill states that in Minnesota, it will be against public policy to sue or prosecute someone who is seeking reproductive care, including abortion. With this bill, courts in Minnesota will not apply restrictive abortion laws from other states in our courts. The bill also states that Minnesota will not limit people's movements should they come to Minnesota seeking reproductive care from a more restrictive state, meaning that we will not extradite people or arrest people for the sole reason that they either performed or sought reproductive care in Minnesota. As I close to turn to my testifiers, I'll just note that most Minnesotans support protecting abortion access and ensuring access to abortion care. And with Minnesota essentially becoming an island within the upper Midwest to provide abortion and reproductive care, it is critical that we act to protect patients and providers in Minnesota and those coming from out of state to seek that care. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to invite, I think there's a couple testifiers.
Yep, we've got a couple people signed up, Christy Hall and then Rachel Dick, and we will need to keep testimony somewhat limited today. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Erin Hart. I'm a staff member at Gender Justice. Christy Hall had a conflict and is sorry she's not able to make it today. I will read her testimony. I work for Gender Justice, a legal and policy nonprofit dedicated to advancing gender equity through the law. We are here today in support of House File 366, the Reproductive Freedom Defense Act. We are deeply concerned about the impacts of the United States Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and the attack on abortion rights, individual liberties, and privacy across the country. Many of these laws seek not only to ban abortion in their own states, but also to reach across state lines, preventing people from traveling elsewhere to get the care they can't get at home, and punishing those who provide abortion care and those who help people who get it. The goal of these laws is to scare providers and patients and ultimately stop all abortions wherever they occur. Our state has the responsibility to protect Minnesotans from the extreme abortion laws of other states and protect all who travel here to seek care. The Reproductive Freedom Defense Act creates strong protections for Minnesota's own health care providers and others who help people get reproductive health care against attacks and criminal penalties imposed by other states. It's the job of health care providers to care for their patients. They are not lawyers. They know and follow the law and regulations in our state and can't be expected to understand the radical and extreme legislation that other states are passing. They need to be able to provide care that is legal in our state to patients without fear of repercussions from other state laws. To protect providers and others helping people receive abortion care, House File 366 ensures that having been disciplined or convicted in another state for providing reproductive health care that is lawful in Minnesota is not cause for discipline or withholding of licensure by Minnesota's Board of Medical Practice. Protects Minnesotans from laws encouraging citizens to sue individuals for providing or helping someone obtain abortion care that is legal in Minnesota. It protects individuals from being delivered to another state under an extradition order for providing an abortion and protects individuals from being arrested in Minnesota under out-of-state laws related to abortion care. The Reproductive Freedom Defense Act protects our rights, privacy, and dignity. As Representative Agbaje noted, there is strong support for these laws among Minnesota voters. In fact, 3/4 of Minnesota voters want to see abortion providers protected against legal action against them by other states that have banned abortion. It is crucial to act now to protect patients and providers in Minnesota and those coming to Minnesota seeking care from the attacks enabled by the Supreme Court decision. Gender Justice urges you to pass House File 366. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Next I have Rachel Dick. And then the final person who was signed up ahead of time was Devorah Herman. If you can be ready to to go ahead. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Dick, and I'm a graduate student at the University of Minnesota. I am here in support of HF 366. The Reproductive Freedom Defense Act is bold and compassionate legislation that our state needs in order to keep people safe. Connecticut and New York have recently passed similar SHIELD laws, and now it is Minnesota's turn to be a leader in the field of reproductive justice. Much of the discussion around the PRO Act was centered on the fall of Roe v. Wade, which was a cataclysmic event in American history. However, the passage of Senate Bill 8 in Texas in 2021 was equally as frightening to me. This bounty law authorized any person to file a civil lawsuit against any other person who aids or abets in an abortion with a $10,000 payout if they're successful. It immediately had a chilling effect on access to abortion even before the Supreme Court ruling in the Dobbs case. Minnesota needs to act decisively to protect our citizens and the people who travel here seeking care from the punitive whims of lawmakers and courts in other states. In Minnesota, we are good neighbors. We take care of the people around us. Today, that means advancing HF 366 to protect women, trans men, and anyone in need of reproductive health care, Minnesotan or non-Minnesotan, from being targeted by subpoenas and civil action from other states. It means defending our physicians from the threat of losing their license for providing care, which is one small way to repay them for the many sacrifices that they make for us. None of us should have to fear financial and legal punishment for exercising the fundamental abortion rights that our legislature just enshrined into law. And I know that I'm so fortunate to live here in Minnesota, but if I didn't, I would be grateful that we exist and that we are keeping everyone around us safe. Please advance this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Devorah Herman. You're not that person.
I'm not.
Please go ahead. We got 2 minutes.
Sure. My name is Abina. I'm here reading testimony because all of our providers are providing care for their patients today instead of fighting with politicians to be able to do their job.
If you could just state your full name for the
sure,
record,
Abina
and then proceed.
Abraham. Thank you. My name is Devorah Herman Judah. I'm a registered nurse and a women's health nurse practitioner. I have worked in abortion care since 2008 and became an abortion provider in August after Doe v. Minnesota ruled it unconstitutional to prohibit nurse midwives and nurse practitioners from providing abortion care. I am now employed by Just the Pill, a nonprofit telemedicine abortion provider with mobile clinical services. My current medical practice is a direct result of the legal process. This is why I'm asking you to support the Reproductive Freedom Defense Act. The RFDA provides essential protection for my Minnesota patients, but more so my patients from beyond Minnesota, my patients from Iowa, Wisconsin, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota, my patients from Florida and Texas. I have helped people from across the nation access reproductive health care in Minnesota. My patients are traveling here from states that no longer protect their reproductive freedom or bodily autonomy. The RFDA ensures that Minnesota will protect them. The RFDA will protect my patients' health records from out-of-state subpoenas and court orders. The RFDA also protects my patients from Texas-style laws prosecuting citizens who help their friends and neighbors access abortion care. And the RFDA protects my colleagues and I from extradition to states where abortion is now illegal. The RFDA provides Minnesota's healthcare providers, citizens, and visitors with essential protection against legal attacks and criminal penalties imposed by anti-abortion extremists in other states. This bill matters to me and my colleagues and the patients we're caring for each day. We need for Minnesota to protect us right now, so please support the RFDA. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Abadji.
Madam Chair, if I may, Senator Morrison is also here. She's the co-sponsor of the bill in the Senate, and we've been co-presenting, so if you allow, just give her like 1 or 2 minutes.
Yep. Senator Morrison, if you want to come up. And members, we did get the approval to go over a bit, so we do have some time for discussion. Senator Morrison, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Senator Dr. Morrison.
Thank you.
please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present with Representative Agbayaje the Reproductive Freedom Defense Act. I just want to add a few comments about what this bill means for patients and providers. I've been a practicing OBGYN for more than 20 years, and over that time, I've experienced a lot with my patients. I've had the privilege of being present for some of their best and most hopeful days and some of their darkest and most difficult. people often say to me, oh, you're an OB. You deliver babies. What a fun job. And it is. When everything goes as planned, it's wonderful and miraculous at times. But it doesn't always go as we'd wish. Sometimes people want or need to end a pregnancy for a myriad of different reasons. And I'm proud that in Minnesota, we are protecting people's ability to make their own private, autonomous reproductive health care decisions. But that's not true in all of the United States, as you've been discussing this morning. Since the Supreme Court ignored 50 years of precedent and overturned Roe versus Wade, states across the country, including all of the states that surround us, have either banned or severely limited access to abortion care. Since abortion care is an essential part of reproductive health care, people will seek care where it is available. So we're already seeing more patients from out of state seeking care here in Minnesota. We know that when states pass abortion bans, the burden is on patients who need access to essential time-sensitive care, and the burden is on providers and clinics in neighboring states to take care of those patients. Patients deserve privacy, and no one should have their medical history used against them in a lawsuit or legal enforcement. And patients deserve community support from their network when seeking care, so we must protect those who assist patients in accessing abortion. It's the job of healthcare providers to use their medical expertise to care for their patients. We know and follow the law and regulations in our own state, but we aren't lawyers and shouldn't be expected to follow radical and extreme legislation that other states are passing. In addition to the protections that Representative Agbaje mentioned, our bill also ensures that doctors and nurses that come to Minnesota to practice are not penalized by our Board of Medical Practice for convictions in other states who have implemented restrictive reproductive health care laws. Our bill also excludes reproductive health care related charges from Minnesota's Extradition Act so that Minnesota will not deliver a person charged with the crime of providing abortion or other reproductive care to another state under an extradition order. We simply cannot allow other states' dystopian and draconian laws to harm people here in Minnesota. This bill is critically important to patients and providers here in Minnesota and across the country. Thank you very much for your consideration of the Reproductive Freedom Defense Act.
Thank you. Any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Representative Agbaje, in my reading of the bill, I'm wondering how this bill would interact with the practice that we've outlawed a few years ago for physicians to perform female genital mutilation. And so I'm wondering how this law would interact with that. Would it make it null and void?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. I do not believe that this bill covers anything related to female genital mutilation, as that is not under what my understanding of reproductive health care is.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, could you point out in this bill where you see the exact language that would leave that law as standing? Because reproductive health care could certainly include that practice, as my reading of the bill.
Representative Scott, if you go to line 2.6, there's a definition of reproductive health care services, and in my reading of that, I don't see anything in that that would apply to the
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Right. So if you look at that definition, it includes surgical, includes surgery, and it says including but not limited to services. So one of the reasons that female genital mutilation is done is regarding making sure that a female's receives no pleasure from the act that would include reproduction. So I don't see any forbidding of that from taking place, and therefore a doctor that performs that against the law would not be liable any longer. They would not be charged with any crime. Is that correct?
Representative Agbaje, although I think it's important that we finish reading the sentence, including but not limited to services related to pregnancy, contraception, or the termination of a pregnancy, and I don't think issues relating to pleasure falls into that category, but Representative Agbaje, I'll let you reply.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. Again, I'll go back to the language that's there. This is meant to cover reproductive health care services, and reproductive health care services, to my understanding, does not include female genital mutilation.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not convinced by either the chair's assurances nor the bill's author assurances. Representative Agbaje, Madam Chair, if I could ask another question.
Yep.
Thanks. So are there any age restrictions on a woman who might receive reproductive services under this bill?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. This bill protects patients who are receiving reproductive health care services. So if that between that patient and their provider, if that is the type of care that they need to receive, then this would protect that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So could someone that's sex trafficking a minor child at 16 bring them here? If let's say the sex trafficker has been charged with a criminal act in another state, could they find safe haven here in the state of Minnesota and bring a 16-year-old here for an abortion and be provided safe haven in this state from prosecution in another state?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. This bill does not protect sex traffickers. It only protects providers and patients.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I think it says in here any other person. I don't know.
Representative Scott, could you point to the line that you're referring to?
You can move on to another member's question while I find that.
Okay.
That'd be perfect. Thank you.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Agbaje. I want to ask specifically about the extradition provision in Section 10, and in particular the language starting on line 6.16, no person shall be surrendered to the executive authority of any other state for acts involving any medical, surgical, counseling, or referral services relating to the human reproductive system, including but not limited to services related to pregnancy, contraception, or the termination of the pregnancy. Specifically, if you're familiar at all with the case of Kermit Gosnell in Pennsylvania, I'm curious whether this provision would protect him if he came to Minnesota and Pennsylvania wanted him extradited.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. I am not barred in Pennsylvania, so I am unfamiliar with this case. So if you would like to give the details.
Certainly.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, Kermit Gosnell was an abortion provider in Pennsylvania and was charged with multiple counts involving both horrendous conditions in his clinic, but also multiple situations in which babies who survived botched abortions were subject of infanticide. And I guess the way I read this, it seems like it would protect someone in that situation because what he was doing was relating to the human reproductive system, including services related to the termination of a pregnancy.
And I think, Representative Agbaje, if it's okay with you, I believe House Research could illuminate how this would be interpreted.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Niska and members, Ben Johnson with House Research. Extradition falls into a couple of different categories. Under the United States Constitution and federal law, states must deliver someone who has fled a different jurisdiction. In the situation that you just described, if an act was committed in the state of Pennsylvania and the person then left the state of Pennsylvania, then under the Constitution and federal law, that person would be considered to have fled the state of Pennsylvania. The Constitution requires that Minnesota agree to and engage in extradition under those circumstances. The section of law that is amended in the bill that you're referencing is not related to that type of extradition. This is an extradition by agreement. Federal law and state law is free to extradite people in other situations, which can include when someone does not flee the state that is requesting the person. This particular section applies to those situations, and it says that if the person commits an act in the state of Minnesota, that language is at 6.1, then Minnesota would not be required and, in fact, would be prohibited from extraditing the person. So in the situation that you mentioned where the act was committed in Pennsylvania and then the person fled the state of Pennsylvania, whether it's technically fleeing or simply leaving and went to another state, then Minnesota would be required under the Constitution, federal law, and state law to extradite that person.
I think that answers your question, Representative Niska, but follow-up.
Not quite, Madam Chair, and I guess I'm curious, and maybe Mr. Johnson is the right person to answer this question. I do see that we have the terms committed and act in this state throughout a number of the other provisions of this, but it's not present in the Section 10, amended 629.06. Can you help me understand why there's no limitation on committing an act in this state to the in the language that I'm looking at here?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Niska, this particular section refers to 629.03 in the existing language. That relates to committing an act in this state or a third state, intentionally resulting in a crime in the state whose executive authority is making the demand. So again, this particular section, as it exists currently, not with the amendment, does not apply to acts committed in another state. It applies to acts either committed in Minnesota or some third state. So for example, using the Pennsylvania example, if the act was committed in Pennsylvania, but another state, say Indiana, wanted to charge for that particular act because there was some relation to Indiana, that is not an act committed in Indiana. And so the person has not fled Indiana. And so under that circumstance, the Constitution and federal law does not require extradition. That's extradition for an act committed in a third state. And so that's what would apply under Section 10.
Representative Niska, final follow-up, and then we're going to move on to other members.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I don't have any other questions about this. I would suggest that paragraph B here perhaps needs to be tightened up about that. But I do have some questions about the full faith and credit clause and how it interacts with this, if you would allow, Madam Chair.
Yeah, just go ahead. It's just taken away from your colleague's ability to ask questions. So,
yeah, so Section 6 and Section 7, I'm interested to hear from the author as to how that comports with the federal full faith and credit clause and the way that that's been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court, in particular in Baker versus General Motors in 1998.
You can tell who has access to Westlaw. Representative Egbadje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. I actually wish that you had presented those cases in front of me so I could review them as well. So as we're looking at this, we are looking at a way to protect Minnesota residents, providers, patients, people who come here seeking reproductive health care. We do know that other states are also passing restrictive laws on reproductive health care that also similarly have the same questions brought up about the full faith and credit. What we're doing here, though, is we're stating our public policy, which is one of those areas that states have been able to do to state their public policy. And then if another state is going against their public policy, that has so far been able to be kind of an area where states are able to kind of assert themselves. And so what we're doing here is, you know, Minnesotans want to see us ensure that the healthcare that they're provided, particularly in the reproductive care space, is protected, that their providers are protected, and patients are protected.
Representative Niska, final follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will suggest that the author review Baker versus General Motors. It's a unanimous opinion written by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in which the Supreme Court held that there was no public policy exception to the full faith and credit clause as it applies to judgments of one state enforceable in another state. And I guess my last question would be whether you're aware of any other state law anywhere similar to Section 7 which not just attempts to not enforce a judgment in another state, but actually attempts to create a civil cause of action that apparently is countervailing to that judgment in another state. I've never, ever seen any law like this in any context whatsoever. I'm curious whether you're aware of anything like that in any context where one state targets another state's judgments and says that you get to have a judgment in that amount in this state.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. I think to the last part of your question, I believe the example of Texas is one that is trying to extend their reach into other states with their restrictive abortion laws. In the case of other states that have laws similar to this, there are at least six: California, Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New York and New Jersey. Sorry. A couple of those have just introduced their bills. You know, unfortunately, we are in a new time, a new era. We've seen that with the Dobbs decision that came out last year, and that has actually fully upended many of the things that we in the United States thought that we had had precedent for. And so I believe states are responding in the way that they know how to protect their citizens, protect their residents from overreach from other places outside of their jurisdiction.
Thank you. And Representative Niska, I think if if we're going to drill people on, you know, certain cases, it may be helpful if we actually desire to have a discussion of the merits of the case to actually have the conversations with the authors or share that ahead of time. Might be more helpful than just proving that you could look something up when those of us have no idea that you're going to do that. So I think if you actually want to have a discussion, it might be helpful to have those conversations and provide that ahead of time. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and Representative Agbaje, for the bill. I just wanted to point out, I have a question, but I also wanted to say that many states are currently banning the right of individuals to travel to receive health care, which is exactly the issue that Representative Niska is addressing here. The idea that this is new, that this is somehow not something that has been confronted by our legal system, is just not accurate. We saw this with marriage equality, individual states taking steps to protect the rights of their citizens to marry, other states not accepting those marriages. That played itself out in the courts. That's what we're talking about here. There are many states that are currently putting very restrictive bans on what individuals can access and where they can go to access that. If we want to protect the right of people to access legal health care in the state of Minnesota, we also have that right. If that is a question that needs to be answered in the courts, it will be answered in the courts. That is not a reason for us not to do what we believe is the right thing to do to protect individuals who are coming here to access legal health care. So to my question, though, you mentioned states that have passed this bill already. Could you repeat which ones they are?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. Yes, the correct list in front of me is California, Connecticut, Delaware, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York.
Representative Finke.
Actually, that's good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, I know we're running late. It was interesting watching lawyers go back and forth at each other.
Well, Representative Johnson, usually the lawyers know what the subject's going to be, so but I'm glad you enjoy that. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Badger. I also have concerns on the extradition side of it. One thing that House File, I think, 91 does, and what our judicial system has done, it has now made partial birth abortion legal in Minnesota. House File 91 wants to codify that.
House File 366 is the one in front of us.
House File 366 is the one in front of us, where a child molester could actually bring a child in Minnesota to have partial birth abortion done against federal law, because it's partial birth abortion are still banned under federal law. But that child child abuser could stay here, send the child back, and the state of Minnesota, under this bill, the way I read it, would not extradite that person back. It's concerning because the way this bill is written, we don't allow for the full faith and credit of other states, which has been a habit in a number of bills going through here. But we're getting more into the extremes, bills being pushed. Earlier they talked about how extreme some of the bills limiting abortion were, yet Minnesota, near side of the aisle, passed one of the most extreme abortion laws in the world. But they call putting some restrictions and some concerns for the child, the patients, as extreme. So this, I have a lot of concerns with the extradition part of this bill. I'm not going to ask any questions because we're short of time, and let us get moving on to vote this bill down.
All right. Final comment, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And I did find that language I was knew was in here somewhere. To the bottom of page 5 and the top of page 6, and it says, except no person shall be surrendered for acts committed in this state. So it doesn't say for any physician. It goes on to say what services they provided. And I circled counseling here because that's a pretty broad statement. Someone that has abused an underage person could say that they've counseled this underage person to come to Minnesota to receive reproductive care. And so that is one of my main concerns in this bill that ties in with the extradition piece. We could be protecting someone that is abusing that has abused a child in another state and harbor them here in my reading of this bill. So I don't know that is your intention, Representative Abadji, but that's the way I read the bill, and I think, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but there are plenty of them in this room, and I'll bet you there's a varying opinion on the reading of that. I'm concerned, you know, we just heard from the guardian ad litem, and we talked about the best interest of the child being paramount, and I think this flies in the face of that when it comes to minors. I also take exception, as Representative Johnson did, by the characterization that laws in other states that are trying to protect kids from this as radical, extreme, dystopian, and draconian. I would argue that that is more applicable to a bill like this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Engbadje, any response and then final words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I appreciate the time and the discussion today. This bill is meant to protect patients, providers, and people who are seeking legal reproductive care in Minnesota. We are using our state's prerogative and ability to protect our residents and those who come here seeking legal reproductive care. And I look forward to continuing this conversation, as it is very important for our state and for people who are worried about the effects of those restrictions coming down in different parts of this country. Thank you.
Roll call.
I figured that's what you wanted. It's okay. A roll call having been requested by Representative Scott, and seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion to re-refer House File 366 as amended to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Minority Leader Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
8 ayes, 5 nays.
All right, with 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way to state gov. And with that, members, we are adjourned.